2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green for entertaining us as always. It's Thursday the 2nd of December and this is Game On. Coming up on the show, one of Dublin's finest, Kevin McMenamin, has retired from intercounty football. He joins us to reflect on his phenomenal career in blue.
It's belted long by Cluxton and it's going to be a Kerry ball, is it? Michael Darren McCauley, brilliant, his Kevin McMenamin. Memories of 2011 as he burst through. The sides are level, McMenamin still going!
He's got it!
He's done it again! Could have taken the point. What a goal from Kevin McMenamin. He spotted Keely off his line. And is that the move that takes Dublin to the All-Ireland final?
So many magic moments. Ralph Rennick will be in the stands for Manchester United's clash with Arsenal a little bit later. We'll hear about his Lokomotiv legacy with Alan Moore in Russia.
The more aggressive, the more intense we win that ball in that very moment, the more we take this intensity and this tempo into the counterattack.
Now, if you're worried about anything when it comes to nutrition over the winter, please do get in your questions. We'll be chatting to dietitian Orla Walsh about how to put our best foot forward over the next few weeks. We'll also hear from Jeff Shepherd. There's trouble in the world of baseball. He'll have the latest.
Now the 2-2. Well hit down the left field line. Way back in. Goal!
Now, if you want to get in touch, please do so. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Now, welcome along. We are going to get straight into Gaelic games and I'm delighted to say that Kevin McMenamin is with me on the line just after announcing his retirement yesterday and I'd imagine has spent the last 24 hours replying to text messages, tweets, emails, all sorts of communication with everybody congratulating him on his career. Kev, how has the last 24 hours been?
Hi Marie, how's things? It's been fairly, it's been overwhelming, I suppose, and very, very nice as well, I suppose, but overwhelming is the feeling, you know, it's coming, they're coming from all angles, but look, it's lovely to hear, I suppose, a lot of the people getting in touch.
Yeah, I'd say so. And like I've just been following it on social media, so I can only imagine the level that's been directed to you personally as well. But the fact that you made such an impact, well, what you did on the pitch made such an impact on so many people, it must be even nearly hard to comprehend.
It is actually, I suppose, like, you know, you're playing away, you love it, you know, you're not doing it to I don't know, you're doing a lot of place for yourself or your family or your club or your teammates, but to be able to spread it a little bit wider as well is great.
So why do you do it then? Like, you've brought that up there. Like, we watch it because we love it and it's entertaining and, you know, it's exciting and there's drama and sport is just brilliant. But the fact that you've given, and so many other people as well, you're one of the lucky ones who has the All-Irelands after the end of the career, but it is a huge amount of commitment as well. It's your whole life in many ways. It defines everything about you during that time. But what is it about it that makes it so special for you? And why do you do it year in, year out?
Yeah, really deep question off the bat, Marie.
Get straight into Kev.
Or why did I do it? I guess, look, I love competing. Do you know, I love that idea that you get a chance every 2 weeks or whatever it is to compete against the best in the country, whether it's the guys that are on your team or whether it's different counties around the country. And I just love that. I love winning. I have a greedy streak that I love trying to be the best I can be and be successful. So that probably drove a lot of it. But being part of a team as well, you know, when you get a group that there's so many people that want the same thing as you and different characters that, you know, different archetypes that give different things to a group, you know, it just feels like it's just great to be a part of it and feel like you're doing your bit. So I could probably go on the why, like, but it always stands out to me that, yeah, it was probably something in me that loved competing, giving back to my teammates, and then maybe representing the people around me, like family and club and stuff like that as well. So, yeah, that's how I'd summarise it.
Did you always love winning and competing, or is that something that the more you got of it, the more that you wanted it? Or would you say that even when you were younger, you had that kind of that streak of competitiveness in you?
I'd say I had it. I'd say there was a streak in me, all right.
Will I ask your brother, Bren? He might be able to answer that.
Ask Bren. I was playing Astro with Bren last night up in Spawell. And, like, it went down to the wire, and his team beat my team in the last minute. So, like, I was in a Fowler coming home last night from the Astros. So, that will tell you that, yeah, it doesn't matter whether it's Crow Park or it's a game of Astro. I like winning, I suppose.
So, how are you going to fill that void? Like, obviously, there's club football, but I'd imagine nothing can compare to the experiences that you had in a full Crow Park.
Yeah, well, look, maybe not. And, like, look, will there be a void? Hard to know. I will be playing with my club. There's probably been a void for other parts of my life that I've left, that I've neglected for 10 years. So I guess it's trying to just pick up those things as well. Like, probably looking forward to getting stuck into more work with my business. Essentially, I'm playing Gaelic for a different team. Won't be playing in Crow Park. But it is what it is. So that's how I'm trying to approach it. Is, look, I've got an opportunity now to do a lot of the things that I just haven't been able to do because commitment and what's expected of you as an inter-county player has kind of decided my lifestyle in a lot of ways. So, yeah, looking forward. Maybe even go to a few weddings. Maybe even get a few little bank holidays away. And yeah, like I said, focus more. I'm actually doing a bit of study and focus more to push my business, my own consultancy in sport. So look, there's loads of stuff. So hopefully that it will fill up my time and give me a bit of joy.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be well busy anyway. So, Kev, let's just go back a little bit, right? So, like, growing up, obviously, playing for Jews, were you somebody that always stood out? Did you make underage county teams on the way up? Like, when did your talent first start to come to the fore?
Initially it was all soccer for me. Like, you know, I would have played, like, with my schoolmates, Templeogue United, until maybe from around under eight, under nines. That was kind of the main thing. And if I could fit Guy in, I'd go. But it was usually after a soccer match or a basketball match. I started getting a bit more into it around maybe 14, 15. And was part of, we had a good hurling team as well. And I was playing a year older. And I guess I just started... I just started loving it and started seeing that, you know, that carrot of playing with Dublin as something that drove me. I was fairly small for in comparison to some of the people in my age group through my teens. So played a little under 17, didn't make the minor team, was a bit small, and then probably drove me a little bit to push on, and eventually got a couple of goals at Dublin under 21. So did I always stand out? I don't know. Like, I didn't actually know, but I think through my late teens and 20s, I certainly would have overtaken a lot of players that I would have had above me, you know, in terms of ability wise, you know.
How did you do that?
I don't know. Like, I guess there was probably a physical change, like, in terms of strengthening up and learning how to win my own ball. You know, that was a thing I always worked on with my dad. Would always have a conversation around winning your own ball, and I would have been a bit light and around 17, 18, so I did a lot of work in the gym and stuff, and then I just kept at it. Like, and I never got too in that period, maybe 18 to 23, probably never got too distracted by, like, the social side of sport. Never got too carried away in going out, like, in college nights and all. I was on good teams in Jews. Even I played 2 years intermediate, and it just stopped me from wanting to go to the boozer on the weekends and wanting to spend too much time with with the lads are out on late nights and stuff. So I guess I just, how did I do it? I was just probably was driven to improve and live the lifestyle of an elite athlete, I guess.
It sounds as well like, Kev, that your multi-sport background did help you a lot, and we're hearing more and more about that as maybe people of your vintage retire. A lot of people that have came through kind of the same time as you seem to play quite a lot of sports, and that really stood to them in that modern game of football.
I've seen your young lads playing Everton, Marie. I think they're on the right track. Yeah, like I played soccer. Now, initially for me, it was something I could play to get off school a bit early, you know. So soccer and hurling, and loved playing basketball. I used to show up playing for Temple Oak Basketball Club with big mucky knees after playing for Temple Oak United. But I do think it's important for development and coordination. All the skills you get from one sport are transferable. I think it's a kind of a no-brainer. For me, it's what you want to call it, athletic development, tactical awareness, or, you know, things like vision and stuff like that. I know it's spoken about a lot, but I think any sport is beneficial for people in others. You know, it's very, one sport leaks into another very well.
Yeah, and we're seeing lots of opportunities for kids now as well. Like, there seems to be a sport for everyone, which is brilliant. So tell me then about your introduction to the Dublin senior team. How did it happen? What was it like? How were you feeling?
I came up. Jude's had a good year in 2009. We got to a final, and it was a kind of a breakthrough for me, I suppose. I started playing well in big championship games, and Paddy O'Donoghue, selector under Pat Gilroy, rang me, and I was 3 months in the gym that winter, I remember it. And yeah, it was a big, Dublin was changing, I guess, at the time. Like, and my intro was, you know, Tuesday and Thursday, 6 a.m. and 7 p.m. on the, you know, in, we used to train in DCU in the hall at 6 a.m. and then we used to train in Ballymun, I think it was, at 7 p.m. So it was a fairly intense intro for me. I remember you had 50 players on the panel, and we'd be training and running up sand dunes at the weekend, and it was a real baptism of fire, I guess, and being around, you know, established stars. Gilroy was very good at leveling the playing field, and I think he kind of had to that year after Dublin were beaten well by Kerry in 2009. So going into 2010, I just got stuck into it. I loved the train. I mean, luckily, Bren, my brother, was on the panel at the time, so he was able to kind of, you know, Mark McCard and a lot of stuff that what would be expected of you, and took it very, very, very seriously. I just went for it as best I could, and Pat Gilroy, in fairness to him, was very generous is maybe not the word, but he really stuck with me even through the first league. It gave me a lot of confidence, because he was like, I see something in you, and if you have a game or two that's a little below par, I'm going to stick with you, you know. And I think that was important for me, because you know, so many players do come into league games, and if they don't play a few games well, they might drift back into the pack a little. So I guess that was important to like, I was going up the level to the stairs maybe very quickly, but it was important that he stuck with me even if I was wobbling a bit, you know.
Yeah, so you had the right people around you from the get-go. Like, we have, you know, as sports fans, and I'm sure the Dublin fans in particular, have amazing memories of the things that you did. We played the 2013 semi-final goal there, and there's reference to that 2011 one as well. And so many magic moments for people, Kev. For you, like, when you think of your favourite time in the blue jersey, what is it?
Geez, how long have you got? I suppose I'll never escape that. That's what people might remember me for, is scoring goals. I guess for me, I just have fantastic memories of spending time with my teammates, whether it's the training camps or, you know, that 15, 20 minutes on the pitch or in the back room after maybe winning the title or something like that. That's the stuff that really stands out to me. I remember there was a 2015 semi-final stood out. We beat Mayo, and I got a goal close to the end, and I that was I was very present for it. Sometimes when the game is going so quick, you mightn't stop and hear the noise of the stadium. You just want to get on with stuff. And that was probably the case in the first few years of playing. But I remember 2015, I scored a goal. I remember just going, listen, drink it in here for a second and look around and stuff. And that was a moment that stood out to me, that just a very personal moment that just felt amazing, I guess. That was one of the best feelings I've had. So that, as you were speaking, that was popping into my mind.
Yeah. And then what about as a player, Kev? Like, how did you evolve as the game evolved as well? Because you were part of a team that changed the game, but also part of an era that saw the game change quite tactically as well.
It's funny, actually, because someone mentioned it, made my mention me last night about goals, scoring goals. And like, he actually was like, I can't remember you scoring a goal in the second half of the decade. I was a bit like, I was a bit down even hearing it. It's like, you were banging them in for the first 5 years of your career. Like, I probably was a bit more direct and a bit more aggressive in the earlier part of my career, and became a little bit more of a, you know, a tactical mind as my career went on. That was your question, was it? About
how you
developed? I think I just, like, I probably got to a stage, and with a lot of my teammates, we watched a lot more footage as the decade went on. We wanted to really know what we were getting ourselves into, and you know, sometimes games were like a chess match sometimes, and the more preparation we did, the better we used to perform. So I probably became a bit more of a thinker, whereas earlier on in my career, it was a bit just kind of, you know, overpower people or beat them with your strength or your body or your speed or whatever it is, rather than your mind, you know. So I definitely became, and I know we would have looked at basketball, and I was helping out a basketball team as well over the years, Temple Oak, and you just pick up more tactical things and you understand the game a bit more as my career went on. So I'm not sure if I probably became a smarter player, maybe. But I wasn't scoring any goals,
It sounds like that just dawned on you last night, and now you're thinking, God, maybe I should have scored a few more in the last few years. I remember, Kev, being at when Jim Gavin took over, and he held a media briefing, and he spoke to us all about how he wanted Dublin to play, and that you were standing on the shoulders of all the players that had gone in the past. And he had very particular ideas of a style of play that he wanted, and he wanted you to be exciting and entertaining and winning, and he obviously achieved all that. Was that important to you as players, that you were playing the game a certain way, or was it just purely focused on processes and performance and ultimately getting the results?
It's hard to answer. I guess a bit of both. And maybe earlier, if Gilroy had told me to, you know, play 15 back, you know, I would have easily done that to get a victory or to win a title. You know what I mean? It wasn't how we appeared to the outside world. Probably didn't matter. But maybe when Jim came along, and I think that the game was ready for a team that would really go for it, and, you know, we were a really, really attacking team, fast transition and kick passing team, particularly in the first few years under Jim. So was it important to us? It was, I guess, that, yeah, it was important that, like, Dublin have a lot of flair players. The way Heppo used to speak about it, like, there's a way that football is played in Dublin. There's a Dublin style, and he would have been referenced in our dressing room over the years. But this is, you know, particularly in that early part of the decade when Jim took over. Like, yeah, this is how we want to play the game. But look, you have to look. There's trends in the game as well, and probably that mid decade was a trend towards these kind of 13-man defence, quick counter-attack team, kind of the Ulster-based football. So I think we liked the fact that it was sometimes totally different styles that we were playing in Dublin versus, you know, the likes of a Tyrone or a Donegal or, you know, these teams that we were coming up against. Like, we liked the fact that we had to unpick the lock but do it in our own way.
mindset is something, Kev, that is often, well, strong mindset is something that's often said about you from your teammates, and the fact that you had went off and trained as a sports psychologist. Was that something that you became interested in when you were in the Dublin setup? Like, do you think that if you hadn't been in there, you would have done it anyway?
I was getting interested in it before I joined. Yeah, I remember like that year breakthrough in 2009 for the club. Like we had someone in that was helping the club, and I just got really interested. Got a couple of big, like, you know, early steps, and got a lot of improvement out of it. So I just kind of got really, really interested in it. So I'd say I would have if I wasn't playing, but then. Look, I started saying, this is what I'd love to do as a job, and was eating up all the books in the off-season that I could, and then I did a two-year Masters and up in Jordanstown, and I've been working on it since. So there was probably a time, maybe a six-month year or two, where it was too much. I was overthinking. I was trying to, you know, figure out everything in my head rather than just, you know, being a bit instinctive, you know, and that's something that I learned to get that balance right maybe towards the end of my career, you know.
Did you ever help out the lads on the team? Like, would you have shared your knowledge and advised them from that sort of a point of view?
A small bit, really. You know, you have to know your place as well. Mm-hmm. Like, you're there as a player, you know. So maybe it might be over a bit of dinner and try this, or a few conversations we'd have. I would have had probably conversations, but it would be from a teammate point of view rather than you're not asking, you know, you're not motivationally, you're not doing motivational interviewing on your teammates, or you're not, you know, yeah. But it might be just, listen, try this, I've seen X, Y or Z do this, or, you know, and it's funny, like with our team, it was always like a sense of like what's best practice, like, and we were very good at looking around the world really for what high performing athletes were doing, so there was a real thirst for learning among a lot of my teammates. So, like, you know, if you give someone a book or you say, have a listen to this podcast, let's talk about it next week, like, 9 times out of 10, they'll do it, like, and they'll try and bring it into their game or to cherry pick what will work for them, you know. So that's how I'd answer the question. But I guess I was always careful of, listen, I'm not at work here, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, trying to have the boundaries there as well. Like, Kev, yeah. 8 All-Ireland titles, and then on top of that, from a professional point of view, you've already worked with an Olympic gold medalist in Kelly Harrington. What you've achieved both from a sporting and professional point of view at 34 years of age is pretty phenomenal.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it was nice. It was hard this summer. It was kind of, the Olympics was, you know, probably always hanging over me a little bit, because I wanted to go, and I'd put in a lot of work over the years with the team. So look, it would have been, you know, nice to try and get in last summer. Whether I would have played or not is another thing. But you know, it was a tough decision. But look, I had to make a decision to, you know, I make a statement to myself about, listen, you're not going to be playing for Dublin for the rest of your life. Like, you know, you have to have other interests, and, you know, and that's why I, you know, ultimately decided that, listen, you know, I got to go to Tokyo and I got to leave this thing behind.
Hard, I'd say.
It was very, very difficult. And see, the other thing about the games was, it was, will it go ahead, won't it? It was cancelled in 2020. I think I felt in 2020 I had probably decided that I wasn't going to go. But so it was like, you know, I guess leaving the team was a little bit like, I didn't pull the Band-Aid quickly. I pulled it off slowly, you know, which is, has its pros and cons, you know. But it was hard, yeah. You know, and I thought a lot about it and reflected a lot on it, but... and it's hard to know if I made the right decision, but look, I had an amazing 6 weeks over at the Olympics. We had 2 medals and, you know, prepared our team so, so well. World-class, you know, coaching and preparation, and it's a shame we didn't. There was a few unsung heroes there that just didn't get a chance to fight for medals. And, you know, you'd like to think that going into Paris in 3 years, that, yeah, we'll have a few more medal hopes, you know.
Yeah, Paris is going to come around really quickly as well. And then for yourself, yeah. Kev, what next? I'm going to predict that you'd love to win a county title with St Jude's.
Oh, I know. I'm
not going to mention the county. Well, you can mention it. So the county final, the heartbreak of it.
Yeah. Look, it was. We put a lot in this year, and look, I've been on that team 16 years trying to win something, and I never did. It's funny. Some young lad came off the bench and scored a goal against the run of play, and then. They kicked this point in the last minute to beat us. I know that's a story that sounds familiar to my own Dublin career. But look, that's what it was. Crokes, probably it was like a bit of an arm wrestle, and they got their nose in front the last second. So it was a challenging one for us. You know, we put a lot in, but someday hopefully we'll get over the line. You know.
Yeah. Well. It'll come around quick enough, I'd say, just given the performances over the season. A really great club team. And look, you're going to have more time on your hands now as well, so no doubt you'll be bringing all of that that expertise to the club team as well. Kev, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you from everybody as well for all those great memories that you gave, not just for Dubs fans, but for football fans everywhere. Magic moments. I'd say they'll be on a loop on many people's YouTube for the next few days since you've announced your retirement. So thank you so much.
No, absolutely. Marie, thanks for having me.
Talk to you soon. Thanks, Emil.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Fern's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, very, very shortly, we will be speaking to dietitian Orla Walsh, and we'll be asking her all of your questions about nutrition and what are best practices over the winter months. So please do get some questions into us. Text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on football.
Now, new Manchester United manager Ralph Rangnick will watch from the stands as Michael Carrick takes charge of the Manchester United first team for the final time tonight when they face Arsenal. Rangnick's first match in charge will be against Crystal Palace on Sunday. There is a huge amount of interest in Rangnick and what he can do with this Manchester United team. So we called on Alan Moore, Russian-based sports journalist, host of Capital Sports on Moscow's Capital FM, to tell us what Rangnick did with Lokomotiv Moscow. You're welcome, Alan. First of all, how is life in Russia for an Irishman?
Well, it's hard now because we don't have cheese from Ireland, which is extremely difficult. But we're getting through it. And the fact that I haven't been able to get home and load up with about 5 or 6 kilos of cheese to come back in bags has made it a bit harder. I'll survive for now. And even the snow isn't getting me down.
Of all the things I was expecting you to say, cheese wasn't one of them. But anyway. So, right, let's talk about Rangnick and the huge amount of interest in him. People are fascinated because they don't know a lot about him. He's a German, obviously, and he's got a certain style of play and beliefs, and he likes to do things a particular way. And there's a lot of, I guess, curiosity about how that will go down with Manchester United, a team full of million-dollar stars.
Yeah, I first sort of bumped into him back over 20 years ago, back in 1998-99 when I was working in Germany and he was working in Germany. I was with Eintracht Frankfurt and he was with a team called Ulm. And then when he moved to Stuttgart, we bumped into each other a few more times as well. And since then, kind of like I've always kind of kept tabs on any people I would have dealt with from Jurgen Klopp, or any of those lads. So I always had an eye on them. And see how we're doing. And then when he rocked up in Russia at the club that I've worked with since 2007 this summer, that was a bit of a surprise. So it has ended very badly for Lokomotiv in a financial sense and also on the playing sense as well. And his legacy, which is going to continue thanks to his consultancy contract with Lokomotiv, has really left a kind of a very, very bitter taste in the mouth here.
Yeah, I was reading about that a little bit earlier and the fact that although he's gone, the club aren't going to abandon what they'd started with him. So they've left people in charge of fulfilling what he had implemented. What exactly is that?
Well, a bit of background on it. I mean, I've dealt with, like I said, since 2007 and then especially worked very closely with them in 2017-18 when they won their first Premier League title in a long, long time. And there was a German man who was working as sports director, but he was doing it in a very clever way and working within the club and liaising directly with players. And he sort of had, you know, developed a great rapport with the fans and was absolutely beloved. But he didn't put anything into, you know, the development of players or techniques or programs. And it was like simply develop the club, like as a proper sports director. Now, of course, when this summer, before last year and this year, they started making some changes. They brought in a Serbian coach, Marko Nikolic, who did an excellent job coming in after a club legend, the only man who's ever won the league with Lokomotiv, Juri Sjomin. And he came in not that well respected by a lot of fans, and I had questions myself about it, but he ended up winning the cup and, you know, making Lokomotiv play in a good way and bringing players through. As soon as Rangnick was announced, we knew what was going on, because the local had tried to sell their training, well, the whole stadium training grounds, where Moscow Shamrock's GAA team trained as well. So they were trying to sell all the grounds out from underneath them, got a massive advance for it, and decided that they were going to then invest in, you know, kind of a pathway for development of players. And Rangnick's company came in, made a presentation, sold to the club, and they ended up signing a deal for 5 years for €40 million with them. And he had full rights of who to, you know, who to work with, who would be coaching the team, and so on and so forth. So he himself picked up a gigantic salary out of it. It was €2.4 million. I think maybe a little bit more than that actually at the time. And he was getting more money than the highest paid player in Lokomotiv. With that, then he got rid, of course, of the Serbian coach, who refused to go along with his programs, and the same then with some of the really senior players, outstanding players like Krychowiak, the Polish international, who literally just walked out of the club and went into Krasnodar. Great stuff for them, and a lot of players and, you know, fans and people within the club have just absolutely they went into uproar. 8 weeks ago now, when we knew that he was in communication with Manchester United, we spoke a bit on Capital Sports and said, this is going to happen, don't worry, he's leaving the club. But what we didn't know was that he had fixed in with his consultancy that he would still be controlling what's happening in Lokomotiv, and he literally handpicked his appointment. Kornetka just told him to stay in Moscow. So his legacy lives on in Moscow, but the club is an absolute, well, I could say free fall at the moment, with a lot of senior players now wanting to move in a January window.
So what are the concerns that the people associated with the club have about this situation now, where his company essentially are going to run the club and he will be a consultant?
Yeah, it's a great question on it. And a lot of it from the Lokomotiv side is perception. Now, we know that for, you know, many years ago, well, not that many years ago, but for many years, Russia has been sort of rightly looked suspiciously in terms of doping and so on. So the Lokomotiv are one of the first clubs to try and, you know, clean up. And they're very, like, they're a multi-sport. They're very much a community-based team. They're sponsored, of course, and owned by Russian railways. So everybody in the Soviet Union has a stake in Lokomotiv Moscow. So they kind of have really tried to up their game and try to do things better. When Rangnick came in, bells began to ring for many people saying, this is not the kind of person we want associated with our club, because of his, you know, past and continued relationships with Red Bull. So when he started bringing people in from Red Bull to sort of advise on how to do things, a lot of the Russian specialists and a lot of the players objected, and that's where it happened. And he has an agreement in place with his consultancy with a very questionable place in Austria, run by a former colleague of his from Red Bull, that people just don't want to be associated with.
So the club have released a statement, and they said that the club is not tied to personalities. It will continue to and will continue to be working after Rangnick's departure. The club will develop in accordance with this strategy. They said that he's done a lot of really good things, and they named a couple of them, and they were, he's brought in a scout department, and a block for medicine and innovation was created as well under his leadership. They're quite, the second part of that is quite interesting, the fact that they would create a block for medicine and innovation and also be advertising it as well as a very positive thing.
Exactly, and this is what sort of a lot of us, I mean, on Monday, Tuesday this week, I was attending a forum at the Erzurum Arena, where the Russian Railways Arena, where Lokomotiv play. So I got a great chance, as always, to, you know, I'm a regular, I take my little lad there, well, I said not so little, he's 12, he'll kill me for when he hears this, but I'll go there with like friends of mine from Moscow Shamrocks, and we'll go to watch games. I commentate on games there, and this week when I spoke with some of the directors there at the club, they were unhappy because now they don't have control over those things. And they brought in people who would work with Bernd Pansold in Austria to advise this. And for them, they find it's very, very dangerous because Russia is still rightly looked at as being a place where, you know, practices in terms of, you know, sports preparation and, you know, well, just openly called, like, you know, doping, that there's been so many questions raised about Russia. And now they're linked with these people who have a very, very, you know, openly bad past. So it's very, very difficult. Lokomotiv can't say anything about it because they're tied into it. And they were in the contract that they would allow this to happen. Scouting is all well and good. Lokomotiv have always had a very good scouting network, a very good academy, a lot of top-class young players coming through. And they also do a lot of recovery of players as well who, you know, might have fallen out of favour from the academy at one club, but they bring them in and give them playing time, you know, in the reserves and, like, bring them up. In addition to that as well, what a lot of the Lokomotiv staff, the Russian staff, don't understand is how come Lokomotiv, from being a very fair club, you know, not getting that many yellows or reds, usually ranking well in fair play, suddenly are getting a lot of yellows, a lot of reds, a lot of out-of-character behaviour, and an awful lot of strange injuries that don't seem to add up, especially that they're, you know, we're being told that, oh, this is a great progress, and now the sports nutrition, sports medicine, and, you know, therapy is very, very, you know, now it's at the highest global level, but more players are getting more injured more often, and very strange injuries as well.
So you and I are obviously here talking on the radio about this, and I'm sure Manchester United, who are one of the biggest clubs, if not the biggest club in the world, will have done their due diligence, and you would expect that they will have investigated all of this before they've taken on Raniak as a manager and decided to keep him on for a further 2 years in a consultancy role. We also know as well, look, sports science, it's advancing all the time. It's now such a big part of everything that clubs do, no matter what the sport is, but it will definitely be interesting to watch the space as well, to see how Manchester United go under him, not just for these first 6 months, but for the next couple of years as well, and see how the team change and even just how their attitude change from watching him over there. Alan, how do you think he's going to get on?
It was funny when this all came about. Now, as I said, we've been speaking about it for a couple of months, and we speak about it even during the summer on air, thinking that this is not a good deal for Loco. We've been reporting, obviously, on all the ins and outs of the sports clubs here and the difficulties at Spartak and how Loco were really in trouble after trying to sell their grounds and, you know, getting a loan in advance, you know, sort of in advance of that. Now, as I said, I've met him before back in the late 90s and again in the early 2000s. And when I met him when he was here first, it would have been, I think July, would have met him middle July, thereabouts. And I spoke to him a few times. And unfortunately, I never got an interview with him, but it was just kind of like missed opportunities where he was busy or I was busy. But we did speak. His whole thing was that his words were, I want to make Lokomotiv the Red Bull of Russia. And that's exactly what he said. Now, if we tried that in Manchester, I don't know if the fans will buy it, but then again, if they start winning, I have an awful feeling that a lot of fans just won't care because it's too big. It's too, you know, they are, as you said, they are, you know, most likely, in every sense, they are the biggest club in the world. So if they're winning, the fans in Singapore don't care what's happening with the players. In Lokomotiv, the players are living locally. The foreign players are sending their kids to school locally. People know who they are. It is a different kind of level. So if they're getting ill or sick or breaking down, suddenly the fans are objecting to it. And it showed there 2 weeks ago when Lokomotiv had a home game in the Premier League and lost 2-1 at home to Akhmar Grozny, having given away, you know, they went down to 10 men fairly early on. Less than 5,000 people were in the stadium. And that's nothing to do with COVID or restrictions. Mm-hmm. They could have had around 20,000 in, but the fans now are starting to stay away. The last time I saw this was back in 2016 under the it was a woman called Olga Smorskaya was heading the club, and it was such a huge disconnect between the fans, open warfare really between them. And the final game of the season, they won, and there were 5,000 fans in the stadium, but the fans walked out during the second half and were met by police. From speaking with the directors and speaking with some of the people who from the fan movements, who are the most multinational, multi-ethnic groups anywhere you'd find in the world, and especially in Russia, they're not happy. So I think that if he has Manu the winning, no problem. If he starts, if he doesn't have any success, if things are breaking down, if players get injured, I think then there'll be questions asked. But I think if Manchester United win, no one's going to care.
Yeah, well, we will find out soon enough. So he'll be in the stands tonight for the Arsenal game, which kicks off at 8:15, and then he's going to take charge for Sunday's outing against Crystal Palace. Before we go, how's your GAA team getting on in Russia?
Well, do you know what? Now, Marie, we have 3 GAA teams.
Oh, very good.
We have a new one started there last year. Called the Simbirsk Celts. They're down in the city of Ulyanovsk, which is around an hour's flight from Moscow, the hometown of Vladimir Lenin. And a new team then popped up this year in Moscow called the Moscow Heenies, named after the poet, obviously.
Great name.
And it's going very, very well. Of course, it's very difficult for us to get out of Russia to play in tournaments in Europe. But then we're doing well. We're growing. We have, at the last training, we had 20-odd people and 12 nationalities, 12 different nations. So we're growing bit by bit, and hopefully we'll get back to Europe and start playing in competitions fairly soon.
Well, it sounds like you're doing great things over there for Gaelic Games. Alan Moore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Game on 2FM with Green Farms. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farms on-the-go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected Tesco's nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. We are now going to cross over to Old Trafford, where Peter Smith is standing by for the meeting of Manchester United and Arsenal. Peter.
Well, Michael Carrick went toe-to-toe with another esteemed German coach on Sunday, more than holding his own against Thomas Tuchel of Chelsea in a 1-1 draw at Stamford Bridge. With Carrick at pains to point out that the team selection was his, as was the tactical structure. The technicalities surrounding Ralf Rangnick's work permit have been concluded for a second consecutive game, though. He'll be sitting it out, with Michael Carrick once again naming the United 11 tonight, with two burning questions. Will he be a little more attack-minded at home? And will Cristiano Ronaldo be included or reduced to another sit on the substitutes bench, which is clearly much to the superstars' aghast? Modern Arsenal United games haven't had the same old Fergie Wenger edge, and if neither team were to challenge him the current top three, that final fourth coveted position is still hugely obtainable with over two-thirds of the season remaining. Arsenal are beginning to get it together under Mikel Arteta with a sequence of 7 wins from 10, and if you look at their recent form as well, they haven't lost a game this season whenever they've forged ahead. At Old Trafford, it's Manchester United against Arsenal.
Thanks, Peter. Looking forward to hearing the team news from Old Trafford when it does emerge. But now we are going to talk nutrition. Thanks to our very kind sponsors, Green Farm Foods. I'm delighted to say that dietitian Orla Walsh is with us to fill us in on what we need to be doing to keep hearty and hale during the winter months. Orla, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. As always, we have lots of questions coming in. Lots of people are wondering what they need to be eating during the winter months, how much changes we may need to make to our diet, if any at all, Orla.
Well, most of us need to make some changes.
Very true.
So from a very basic level, 80% of us aren't eating enough fibre. So we tend to not be eating enough fruits and vegetables. So the intake is well below the 5 a day, which is actually more like 7 a day. So they're really important for lots of reasons. They protect us against ill health, but things like vitamin C is of course really important for the immune system. So if we eat our 5 a day, or better yet 7 a day, we'll certainly be getting enough vitamin C. Animal produce tend to be a really good absorbable source of zinc, particularly things like shellfish. So shellfish is extremely high in zinc, but all meats would be too. So, you know, there is some plant sources of zinc if you don't eat animal produce. And that would be things like wheat germ, as well as some seeds, so pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds. And I'd encourage people to roast them if they want to assess the nutrients. But don't underestimate the power of hydration. So, you know, even 2% dehydration can affect us in a great way. So it can affect our mental acuity, which is our speed and accuracy of thought. And I think hydration is something a lot of us are confused about. So we think that tea, coffee, and even beer is dehydrating. And the research shows that actually, now I'm not advocating them as your main source of fluids, but taken in small amounts, they're not dehydrating, and they do account towards your fluid intake in the day.
So what about supplements then, Orla? Like, is there anything we should be taking during this time?
So if you're very athletic, a vitamin C supplement is a good idea. Everyone should be taking vitamin D anyway, certainly between Halloween and St. Patrick's Day. So 10 micrograms are 400 international units for most of us. But the browner your skin, the higher you need to take. So you might need to take 20 micrograms, for instance. Echinacea might work. So that might be a good idea. It also might not. And zinc lozenges are a really good idea if, for example, you get a cold. It will help reduce the duration. So take them ASAP, and that might help. But I wouldn't, you know, dismiss the whole good old-fashioned good nutrition. And, you know, in the winter months, if you do diet, it does mean you'll be not sending enough calories your immune system's way. So your immune system won't be as strong if you're purposely dieting and cutting calories or doing it accidentally.
Now, the big one, Orla. So I was out shopping today and found it really hard not to throw in some giant tubs of sweets into my trolley. And I just figured it's only the 1st of December. I need to cool the jets now, maybe wait a few weeks. But just when we look at Christmas and the damage we can do in many ways when we overindulge for too long, do you have any tips to try and stay relatively on the straight and narrow? I know it's not possible for the whole time, but like starting in December... And going for a whole month is probably a bit extreme.
So I'm glad you said that, because, you know, everyone kind of goes, oh, is this the Christmas dinner? And you're like, no, that's generally not the thing that makes our bodies change over the month. It is the month of festivities. So I encourage people to maybe do a little bit more exercise, especially outdoors, even though it's cold, because we get more benefit from exercise when we do it outside, especially for our mental health. I would encourage people to move more, to sleep more. So try and focus on that, because if you're not sleeping well or you're sleep deprived, you'll be prone to look for quick energy through high sugar foods. So I'd focus on that. I think it's a great idea to focus as well on making lots of soups. So fill up on the vegetables and get them in that way. Like, we all need to warm up with food as well as with clothes. So food does warm us up. So generally, it's called diet-induced thermogenesis, but around 15% of the calories in food are used up using it. So do eat regularly and have warming foods to heat up this winter. And then as well, if you have adequate protein at all your meals, you'll be less likely to crave foods in between meals. And interestingly, there's been studies that show that if you have higher protein breakfast, your hunger, you're better satiated during throughout the day. So your hunger levels are more controlled, and it also helps control things like blood sugar levels. So I would encourage people to focus on breakfast and lunch in particular, because people tend to get enough protein at dinner.
Very good tips, and I'm actually delighted now I didn't go for the sweets. I'll wait another few weeks.
Or no, I got them in at Halloween.
Did you?
Probably shouldn't have eaten that.
Thank you so much. And thanks to Green Farm as well for their continued support. And Orla, we will check in with you soon, no doubt. In the new year, we'll be looking for some tips on healthy habits. We'll talk to you again soon, Orla.
Great, thank you.
Thanks a million. So that is all we have time for today on the show, but we will be back tomorrow with a jam-packed Game On. We will have Alan Cawley and Fergal Brennan looking ahead to the Premier League and looking back on tonight's action as well. Jane Mangan will mark our racing card. Bernard Jackman will bring us up to date on everything that is happening in the world of rugby and preview those URC games that are coming up. And we will also get Shep on because we didn't manage to get to him today and there is a lot to go through with him about the baseball saga in the US. So yeah, we'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Tara Kumar is up next.
Game On on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide.